Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. Local story this month is the fact that the Sikorsky Airport has been sold to the Connecticut Airport Authority. Now, I do want to preface that the FAA still has to give the stamp of approval, but it's essentially a done deal. And Kevin Dillon is here this morning, the CEO and the executive director of the Connecticut Airport Authority. Good morning, Kevin. Welcome back to the show. So glad to have you. How are you?
Good morning. Great to be with you.
How are you feeling about the deal? Let's just go right into it.
Well, we're very pleased. That was a major step last week. We still have other steps to go through, though, before you could say the actual sale has been completed. Last week, the airport commission voted to recommend to the city council that the airport be sold to the CAA. So there still needs to be a city council vote before the acquisition can actually be processed. And then following the acquisition, there are a number of steps that have to go through with the FAA as well. So we're still a bit away from saying it's a final deal, but admittedly, last week was very significant to get that vote.
This has been months, if not years, in the making, Kevin Dillon. I was telling my bosses the other day, I think I've been having you on the show since last summer. We've been talking about this and sort of waiting to seeing. I mean, it could have been even before that, my producer saying. But I know you and I have talked about this for quite some time. Just to give people some background, how long have you been sort of eyeing the Sikorsky Airport?
Well, this goes back years. Quite frankly, if you go back to the 2016 time frame, we actually assisted Sikorsky with some management issues at the time. That's when we became very familiar with the airport, and we actually started talking to the city about a potential lease or acquisition back in 2018. So there's been a number of years that this conversation has been underway. And as I've said many times before, we believe there's a real opportunity to develop Sikorsky for the benefit of the local communities, for the benefit of the local economy. And whether that's commercial service at the airport or just continuing to develop the airport as an important general aviation facility, there's opportunity out there, and we want to take advantage of that.
Kevin Dillon is here, the CEO and the executive director at the CAA, the Connecticut Airport Authority, and the City of Bridgeport Airport Commission sold Sikorsky Airport or agreed to have the Connecticut Airport Authority take it over for $10 million. Now, that was a point of contention a little bit, Kevin, and I wanted to see if you could weigh in on it. The town of Stratford also had a lot of interest in this for several years, and we've talked to Mayor Hoydick about this on the show. They offered $13 million. Why do you think the commission went with you guys?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. I think first and foremost, you have to understand on the acquisition price, the city of Bridgeport can only extract a certain amount of money from a sale. That's under FAA regulations. The city can only take out of this sale what they put into the airport with non-airport revenues, right? So calculation, you know, typically that's a six-year look-back period. We have gotten the FAA to agree to go back a little bit further than 6 years, but the city will have to demonstrate that they've put in at least $10 million to achieve or to be able to take the $10 million that we're willing to pay for the airport off the airport. So when you start talking about 10, 15, 20, the reality is it's limited by that FAA look back and what the city can take off the airport. So when you start talking, you know, 10 versus 13, the reality is if the city of Bridgeport could only take 10 off, the other three would have to be invested back into the airport. Well, we're talking about significant investments beyond the $10 million that we're willing to pay for the airport. Because keep in mind, all of the pavement surfaces have to be done at the airport. There has to be terminal construction undertaken. We have estimated that it will take about a $62 million investment to bring the airport up to the standards that we would like to see in order to attract commercial service. So, you know, if you want to look at it, we're prepared to offer the $10 million, and then we're talking about launching a $62 million program to bring the airport up to standards.
So what is the standard you're looking at, Kevin? What would you envision Sikorsky's standards to eventually be?
Well, we pointed folks to the recently approved master plan that talks about the resurfacing of runways, the widening of the runway, not extending the runway. We think that's a very important point to make. We are not looking to extend the usable length, but we would like to widen one of the runways that is less than standard for commercial operations. We're also talking about first building temporary terminal facilities while a permanent terminal can be constructed. But we're also looking at, you know, private investment as well, the potential for fixed-base operators to invest. We have some good fixed-base operators right at the airport today. There's other interests on the outside that would like to come into the airport as well. So those are all the things that we're looking to launch. But when you talk about commercial service, very, very important to get those runway surfaces repaved and that terminal construction completed. So when you talk about process, we still have to complete the acquisition. Once the acquisition is done, we then need to launch these construction programs as well.
I mean, if everything were to go through, or even where we're at right now, if you were to sit here and come up with a ballpark idea, when do you think commercial airlines would continue, would come back to Sikorsky and we'd see commercial passenger flights?
Well, we'd like to think we could start at least some level of interim operation within a year or two of acquisition. Now, a lot depends on, you know, how quickly we can advance some of those construction programs, but there is interest out there. You know, one of the reasons why we're very interested in moving forward with the acquisition right now is we're working with an airline that has expressed a very strong interest in terms of starting operations at the airport. That's what we're looking to accommodate in the near term. And then, as I said, you know, we would be looking at a 5- and 10-year plan for ultimate development of the airport, which encompasses GA improvements as well.
We're chatting this morning with Kevin Dillon, who's the CEO of the Connecticut Airport Authority, and the CAA got the green light from the City of Bridgeport's Airport Commission last week. It was huge news. And it continues to be because it's going to mean a big future for Sikorsky. I want to just double back for a quick second, Kevin, if you don't mind, going back to the runway. In speaking to Mayor Laura Hoidick out of Stratford, one of the things that she said she and residents in Stratford are worried about are, again, the extension of the runways. And you have absolutely no plans to do that. That is not something in your short-term, long-term end goal plans for Sikorsky, it sounds like.
No, we have no plans to extend the runway length. There are carriers that can operate off of the existing runway length at Sikorsky today. And we know that there's been a lot of confusion over the past couple of weeks regarding a bill that was in the legislature that would, I guess I'll use the term, codify the authority that the CAA already has for eminent domain. Typically, if we're to exercise eminent domain, we use it in cases where we have to make sure approaches to runways are clear. Typically, that would involve tree removal, for example. That's how we've used eminent domain in the past. And I have committed to the mayor. I've stated it publicly many times already. We have no intention of using any authority that we have to eminent domain property, to annex property, to increase the size of the airport.
So
it's
for
simply not necessary for the plans that we have going forward for Sikorsky.
Okay, so for like, so currently, for anyone who doesn't know, the CAA oversees like Bradley International Airport. So the I would say the power, I'm going to say the power that the CAA has, you've never had to use that power to extend a runway. You're saying you've used it to remove trees or maybe fix signals or something in order to have landings and takeoffs to be safer. Is that what I'm understanding?
That's correct. One of the responsibilities that the CAA has, in addition to operating 6 airports in the state, we also have regulatory oversight over all airports in the state. And part of that regulatory oversight calls for us to exercise our authority to remove obstructions from runway approaches at any airport in the state. So that authority already exists today involving Sikorsky. In the past, we've had to exercise that authority at Tweed New Haven, for example, another airport that we don't own and operate, to remove a tree that was interfering with the safe approaches to the runways. So that's the only exercise of eminent domain or condemnation power that the CAA has and would be exercising in regard to any airport in the state.
I'm curious, Kevin, and maybe it's too soon to say it, or maybe you're just not allowed to say it, but I'm going to ask it anyways. Any chance you'd spill who is interested in having commercial airlines here?
Well, unfortunately, until we reach an actual understanding with the airline, they have asked us to keep that information confidential at this point for obvious reasons. But I'd like to think that once this acquisition is done, we can formally announce who we're looking to partner with as in regard to the airline service. You know, once we acquire the airport, there's going to be a number of processes underway. We do anticipate requests for proposals for private investment into the airport. We are hearing that there are a number of companies that are interested in investing. But when it comes to the airline, you know, we want to be very cautious in terms of the partnership we're looking to develop. Because as you can imagine, bringing a commercial airline into the airport as a partner becomes central to the ultimate development of the airport going forward.
I mean, it's worked really well for Tweed, it seems like. If you're a Tweed Airport fan, the Avelo partnership for them has been life changing. And I'm wondering, is that what you're kind of looking at? Is like a one airline, multiple destinations, direct flights, and kind of growing that over the time, sort of the way that Tweed has done things with Avelo?
Yeah, I think a very similar rollout is something we're looking for. I think, as you pointed out, Avelo has done great things for Tweed Airport, and I believe will continue to do great things going forward. At Sikorsky, because of the runway length, it's going to be limited as to the actual airlines you can deal with. There are only certain airlines that have aircraft that can operate off of that runway length. Tweed may be a little bit different in that, you know, Tweed is moving forward with a runway extension program. As I said, we would have no intention of doing that at Sikorsky. So when we talk about commercial service, it's what I would call niche service, but it is with a very viable airline, and we do foresee multiple destinations out of Sikorsky.
I know you and I had talked so many times about this, but potentially like going very quickly to cities like Philadelphia, for example, or Chicago, or even going down to Florida, maybe the Carolinas. Does that still seem like that's in your wheelhouse? Is that sort of still what we're looking at for destinations at this point?
Yeah, absolutely. The strategy we would be looking at is to always try to provide Florida service. That's extremely important out of any Northeast destination. So that becomes a real possibility with the carrier that we're talking to. But we're also looking for this carrier to tie into other hub cities so that you would have one-stop connectivity out of Sikorsky essentially to anywhere in the world. So that is the strategy we would look to employ.
Well, Kevin, we always appreciate that you come on. And actually, a few minutes ago, my producer in the commercial break said it was back in 2020, fall of 2020, you and I started having these conversations. And here we are, 2022. And you are pretty much just a couple of I feel like, crossing T's and dotting I's away from owning the Sikorsky Airport. So I really appreciate that you have kept us in the loop all this time. And I look forward to having you on again really soon. Thank you.
We look forward to it. We look forward to wrapping up this deal.
It's very fascinating. I don't know if we've heard of something like this happening before. And for some of that outlook, I wanted to have Bill Bloss back on the show. Bill is our legal expert. He also is with Koskoff, Koskoff & Beter, which I want to just make very clear has absolutely nothing to do with this investigation, with this trial, with this case. I just like to go to Bill for his expertise and his outlook on these kinds of cases. Good morning, Bill. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. Good.
So, the Fitbit murder trial, I mean, when this first came to be, had you ever heard, in your professional opinion, had you ever heard of something like a Fitbit being sort of the smoking gun, the thing that was going to change the course of how this played out?
Well, so it's a little unusual maybe with a Fitbit specifically, but it's not at all unusual that there's electronic data, most often a cell phone or even a laptop. But the amount of data that are in cell phones now would surprise most people. And it is very common that they're used to pinpoint locations, pinpoint conversations, obviously texts. But you know, your phone can be downloaded and will tell police where you are at any instant in the day, going back a period of time. So no, the Fitbit is a little bit unusual. The electronic data, not unusual at all.
I mean, in this situation, Bill, it was clearly, I mean, it didn't save her life, but it did give the conviction that her family was hoping for and giving the justice that Connie's family had been hoping for. And thank God she was wearing it. In recent years, Bill, have you dealt with any cases where technology was a key part in winning a case or changing a case?
Oh, sure. For example, if a cell phone is used to make a call, the location where the cell phone is used can be triangulated, even if the location software is turned off. So, in other words, the police can triangulate from what cell towers the call bounced off of to put a person in a particular location quite clearly. Easy pass data. I was involved in a trial where a truck driver claimed that he got his 8 hours of sleep before driving, and he got in an accident. He claimed that he was asleep in New Jersey, and easy pass data established that during the middle of when he said that he was asleep, he was actually going through the toll station on the George Washington Bridge. So he lied, and the electronic data showed that he lied. So this is something that we've seen over the last 20 years. I call it the CSI effect. Jurors want to have electronic data. They want to have DNA evidence. They want to have something more than just a witness saying, I saw the person do it. And they want some scientific or electronic backup evidence that establishes beyond not only a reasonable doubt, but really any doubt that the version of events that the state or the government is trying to prove is what happened. It's been a fascinating development in the law.
I agree with you. Bill Bloss is here. He's an attorney with Koskoff, Koskoff & Beter. Has absolutely nothing to do with the Fitbit murder trial, but he is our legal expert here on the show. I love to get his perspective on some of these cases. You know, it's interesting you say that, Bill. So my husband and I started watching the documentary on, I think it's Hulu, The Girl from Plainville, about the case out of Massachusetts where the high schooler ended up taking his own life, and it was his girlfriend who had kind of texted and prompted him to do so. Big national case years ago, obviously you know about it. And it was interesting, sure, because, you know, they bring all these witnesses to the trial, and essentially it really didn't matter what the witnesses had to say. It just all came back to the text messages. And you know, you talk about this big shift in sort of the strength of technology over even a witness. And obviously witnesses will never go away, but do you think more cases will be kind of like this? I felt like was a very quick trial. It was like, yep, we've got the data. Here's a couple of days we work on it. But boom, I mean, the jury was done with this in 3 hours. They made the decision. Do you think we're nearing a time where, as long as technology is on the table, these trials can be wrapped up a lot quicker, can be a lot cleaner? Like, what do you think about that?
Well, it was actually a rather long trial, interestingly, but it seemed to boil down to one issue. And that, at least from media reports, and you know, and I will say, by the way, Melissa, I've never been involved in a trial that was 100% accurately reported in the
sure,
media,
right.
And so I'm really just going on media reports on this one. I didn't watch it, but it seemed like it boiled down to one pretty salient fact, and that is that the timeline that the defendant gave the police on when the police showed up to the house was just simply inconsistent with the electronic data, mm-hmm. like the data from the Fitbit, like data from his laptop, in terms of when he was allegedly tied up in the folding chair. There, I guess there was some activity on his laptop, which seems pretty inconsistent with the story that he gave
the situation
the police.
You're so, in.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, so and he testified at the trial, and that's not unusual in that circumstance. He really doesn't have much of a choice. But, you know, once the jury believes he's a liar, then the reason they believe he's a liar is not just because they think he's, doesn't look like he's telling the truth. I mean, if you say something that there is electronic data that contradicts it, then it's much easier to believe the electronic data than it is the oral testimony. I think that's human nature.
We're chatting with Bill Bloss this morning. He's our legal expert on the show with Koskoff, Koskoff and Beter. But just to make sure everyone knows, Koskoff, Koskoff and Beter has nothing to do with the Fitbit murder trial. I just strictly love to talk to Bill because I think he has incredible legal expertise. So, Bill, here's my question. I have a smartwatch, for example. Great smartwatch. It works beautifully. But sometimes when it gets down to about 5% on its battery life and I charge it, it's almost like it takes in so much juice that my watch goes wackadoodle. And it'll sometimes be hours off. It'll show me like on Pacific time for some reason. I'm surprised that in court cases like even the Fitbit murder trial, there weren't more questions about the accuracy of tech. Because we've all seen it. Tech giants have even made mistakes where there are blackouts, where things go wrong, there are glitches. I'm surprised that I didn't watch the trial from start to finish. As you mentioned, I only watched it through media. But my understanding from our partners who were in the courtroom, there were never really a lot of remarks as to how do we know that the Fitbit wasn't just acting up or wasn't, you know, I don't hear that a lot. Or maybe you do in court. Could you maybe respond to that?
Well, it really, in order to get it into evidence, you would have to have some foundation that it's reliable. In other words, you wouldn't just download the Fitbit and say and wave the results around and say here it is. The state would have to put somebody on to say, okay, it's not perfect. It might be off by a minute or two. It might be off by a street or two, but it's fundamentally on the data that we're using, it is foundationally accurate. I think the defense attorney did argue that the creators of Fitbit introduced a more modern version of Fitbit 2.0, like a year after this Fitbit was made, that was more accurate. But fundamentally, that argument that it's not perfect technology is going to be grist for the jury mill, and it's something you can argue as a defense attorney. But depending on what the foundational evidence is, it's either could carry the day or it's just simply not.
And it seems like tech experts are on hand to go to the stand too, because I think they did have just someone who's like a Fitbit expert come and take the stand to explain it, like literally not to speak on the case, but just to speak on the accuracy of Fitbit. I do believe they had somebody do that as well.
Yeah, you still need a foundation when you're introducing cell phone location data, for example. You're going to have to put somebody on to say, here's how it works. It pings off this tower, it pings off that tower. That's something you wouldn't expect a jury to know. And second of all, you still have the foundational requirement of introducing evidence that the electronic data is accurate.
Bill Bloss, I always appreciate having you come on the show. If anybody ever wants to contact Koskoff, Koskoff and Beter, how do they contact you guys?
Easiest way is through the website, Koskoff, K-O-S-K-O-F-F, .com.
All right. Bill, always appreciate you having you on the show. Thank you so much for your time.
Anytime.
It's time to get up and get moving. Workout Wednesday. Melissa in the morning on WICC 600.
May is Stroke Awareness Month, and I thought it was a great time to talk to Amy Linus about two sides of this. One, if you are recovering from a stroke, or how to prevent getting a stroke. So good morning. Thank you so much for being here, Amy. Glad to have you on the show. How are you?
Morning, Melissa. I'm doing well. How about you this morning?
I'm doing good. Thank you so much. I'm so glad to have you here. Yeah, I wanted to talk about both sides of this because obviously there are probably more people who fall on the I want to prevent having a stroke. We'll certainly talk about that. But for those folks out there who have experienced a stroke, but they want to get back into some physical fitness, they want to be able to recover from this and try to regain the life that they had, what would you suggest? What are some beginner or kind of easing back into fitness, what kind of advice would you give them?
So, you know, oftentimes whenever you have a stroke, you experience a muscle weakness on usually generally one side of the body. So I would highly recommend and suggest to kind of focus on exercises that you can do to kind of regain that mobility and that coordination on your less dominant side of your body. And, you know, maybe even add a little bit of weight here and there to that side of the body so that you can kind of balance both issues back out.
So I would imagine you'd probably recommend somebody work with a trainer for this.
Oh, yes. Don't go out on your own on that. And then, you know, also keeping your circulatory system in check and intact. So cardiovascular training would be another key there because we want to have that optimized blood flow going on.
And I'd imagine your body feels so different, Amy, after you have a stroke. It's kind of hard to gauge if you're having any, you know, if something is wrong or if it feels good.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is, like, if you don't work out too often, you and I do. So we're very familiar with that, like, feeling good hurt or that good pain. But how do you differentiate that it's good pain versus, wait, you might be pushing it too hard?
So your body will always let you know, like if your blood pressure goes through the roof or if your heart rate starts to accelerate a little bit too quickly, I mean, those are telltale signs. If you start to have tingling or numbness in your extremities or something, or your body just doesn't feel like it normally does, then I would advise you to kind of back off. But again, like we were just saying before, it's best that you work with someone who has the experience and who can kind of help guide you as to what feels normal and what should feel normal and what doesn't feel normal.
We're talking to Amy Linus this morning. She is our wellness coach here on the show. And Amy, let's talk about how to prevent having a stroke. I'm sure there are certain things that we could be doing just to actively prevent ourselves from having this happen, other than genetics. There's nothing we could do about that. But what could we actively do to prevent this?
You are 100% right. And there are a couple of key component things that you can actually do right off the bat. And one of those is to maintain healthy blood pressure. And you guys are probably like, well, how am I supposed to do that right away? Well, this is a little trick. And I'm sure a lot of people out there are guilty of this. Whenever you're cooking your food, how many of us do we add salt to the food while we're cooking it, right?
So I have not had salt in my food since I was a child because my mom is terrified that we're going to have a stroke.
Well, then you're good to go, Melissa.
I don't have salt in my house. I literally don't have salt in my house. I think my mom would kill me. Yes. I'm not joking.
So I'm kind of similar to you, too. I really don't use it very often. But what I do is I won't cook with it. And if my food needs a little bit of salt added to it, I'll do it after it's cooked. Therefore, I'm not getting double the amount of sodium. So that's a little trick right there that a lot of people aren't aware of. Don't cook with it. Just salt, you know, salt your food after. And then switch over to Himalaya pink salt. That's actually a lot better for you, and it's more natural, and your body will absorb it a little bit better. And then another thing, too, is to reduce saturated fats in your diet. Those hard, dense fats like fried foods, all of those things. If you're going to have them, just limit your intake of them and, you know, also start exercising. Exercise is going to be key. Making sure that your circulatory system, like I said earlier, is working properly and you're getting enough oxygenated blood flow to the brain, because a stroke basically is just an interruption of blood supply to the brain. So there you have it.
Really great tips. So, Amy, if people want to contact you, they want to learn a little bit more, get some of your other tips on there, supplement ideas, things like that, where can they go?
Oh, fitbodyvibe.com. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube as well. I'd love to connect with you guys online.
All right. Amy Linus, I love having you each and every week. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. I love being on with you, Melissa. You're such a breath of fresh air. Have a wonderful day.
See, how can you not want people like Amy Linus in your corner every single week? Thanks, Amy. I'll talk to you next week. I look forward to it.